Mark Scott, welcome to the Homilist Podcast.
Thank you, Jared. Good to be back with you.
I appreciate you coming and doing this. Yeah, we've met once before, and then we had a video hitch, and I lost it all, and I was so disappointed. So I appreciate you being kind enough to come and do
it. There was probably some providence of God there.
So. Yeah, it could have been operator error. Yeah, that's what it probably was. So I was just getting rolling, and man, I was disappointed. I was really down on myself for that. So, yeah. So tell us where you are right now, what you've been doing. So people can kind of get an idea of what you've been doing for the last, you know, I knew you in school and you were a preaching professor then. And so like, what's changed for you?
Well, it's in a state of change. It's like the present, the perfect tense, you know, it's already it's happening. This is my last semester coming up at Ozark as a full-time professor. So that's after 35 years here. Mm. Jason Posnick is our new preaching professor chair, and he'll do a great job. So I'm transitioning. I'll teach a little bit part-time online classes and my self-disclosure seminar that I do into the future. But we've accepted a calling of a church here in Joplin, the Park Plaza Christian Church on the south side of Joplin. So I will return to located church ministry again, and won't be full-time with the church there till June when my time at Ozark completes in May. But I'm already preaching there every Sunday. So I just came through a Christmas series and got one more Sunday to do with that. We are doing a series out of Matthew's early chapters on Meet the Davidson Family, since Jesus was the son of David. And I had a blast doing it. Stole the label from my oldest son, but put my own stuff to it from the early chapters of Matthew. So this coming Sunday, we'll do Matthew 3 and 4 and trying to show how Jesus retraced the steps of Israel, that he's the real Israel, the true Israel of God, and that sometimes we go forward by going backwards. That's kind of the theme. So I'm having a blast.
That's cool.
Sermonizing again in a full-time way. I'm planning out my 2021 sermon plan on what we're going to do there at the church. This is a kind of a mature congregation, older folks, traditional or classic music, but they're really excited. They're debt-free, and they give 24% of their budget to missions, and they're pretty active. So in the last few years, they've gone from about 70 people to about 200, and that was before COVID. But now, even yesterday, we had 164, I think, or something like that in church. So that was pretty good for us. So I'm just kind of looking forward to this next season, being in the preaching ministry saddle again in the local church.
That's fantastic. Well, yeah. I wonder for you, what differences have you already noticed from preaching in a classroom and preaching in chapel and preaching at like kind of sporadic churches to now it's your congregation, it's your flock, and I use your very loosely. I don't.
I appreciate that. Well, there is a difference. This is one of those strange eras in church history where we have five generations of people going to church at the same time. And that creates some interesting dynamics. So my time in the college classroom has kept me around college kids, which, I won't say that I'm woke on everything, but I, by any means, but, you stay young in your head a little bit as a result of that. And now, I'm definitely on the other side of the spectrum, dealing with still the people who are left of the builder generation, an awful lot of my people, the boomer generation. I'm part of the second largest demographic in America after the millennials. And so to me, I want to win my generation. There's a lot of people my age on the south side of Joplin, and we want to make an impact with them. Yesterday in a sermon, I made a reference to, this is not the same culture that we used to have. It based on a book that Todd Bolsinger wrote called Canoeing the Mountains, and that we've entered into a time of culture that's not like, so I referred to Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver. And I said, nobody watches those. And somebody from the audience said, oh yes, we do. And so I thought, oh boy, I forgot my audience. Yeah, they're watching the reruns. Some of those people saw the original version like me. Right. So anyway, but like Fred Craddock says, we're more alike than we're different. Yeah. We still are sinners needing grace of God. And so, while there are generational differences, that would be a difference. And how we speak and the illustrations we pull to communicate. But the underlining things are still there, that we're needy, we're sinful. We need God's grace and God's love. We need redemption. We need resurrection. We need to practice resurrection, in the words of Eugene Peterson and his commentary on Ephesians. So helping people know how to live out resurrected life is kind of exciting, no matter what generation you're talking to.
Yeah, I appreciate what you said about winning your generation. You know, I mean, it's, you see kind of a different mentality a lot of times where, you know, we got to get the kids, and it's kind of like, you know, maybe focus on your people, like where you are, you know, those are the things. I mean, that's one of the things I think about in ministry is, you know, there's certain, you take a young family and you say, all right, we'd like to start a men's group. And we'd like to do it at 6 o'clock in the evenings. Yeah. And so could all you guys look, I've been tucking kids in bed. I'm making dinner. I'm changing diapers. Are you kidding me right now? You know, it changes it. So you find some people in the same season as you, it's a little bit different. Yeah.
And Jared, I don't know what I think about target audience. You know, a lot of guys have really emphasized that Christ Church of the Valley down there in Peoria slash Phoenix, Arizona. You know, they've targeted that 35-year-old male. They think if they get him, they'll get his family and stuff. And it's worked. It's done well. I've heard Jim Cimbala speak in person from Brooklyn.
Tabernacle.
And, you know, he says, target audience? What are you talking about, target audience? And I'm in New York City. Good grief. And so there's different ideas about that. Certainly we've got to win our generation. We've got to win the kids. Yeah. I'm not against that. But, you know, not all of us speak the same language as our hearers. And so I suppose there's some extent that always gets translated to certain age groups.
Yeah, that's true. Well, hey, let's hop into this. I got a couple specific questions for you. And this is, I always enjoy, one of the things I enjoy most about anytime I get to hear you lecture on preaching or in your preaching classes, and when I've come and I've sat in the classes that I've gone through with you, when I hear you talk about some of your favorite preachers or a sermon that you'd recently heard, and some of the guys that like you like to listen to or that have really done something to capture you, I'm always far more interested in the people who inspire somebody like you, because that's got to be a top shelf preacher if they're doing something to inspire you, because you've heard preaching done poorly, done a million times, done really great, and so if you find you some who just knock your socks off, that's always exciting to me. So give me a few of them, of some of the guys and some of the things they've done and said.
Well, I would listen to some that lots of people are listening to out there, because I feel like I should. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the Andy Stanleys and the Matt Chandlers and the people like that, I find them valuable. I find them helpful. Just to be honest, and no stones throwing here at all, but they're not my favorite guys.
Yeah,
I think they're solid. They're good. You can't debate what they've done. You know, the proof's in the pudding. Mm-hmm. So I think I should listen to those. But probably along the lines of more favorite people, certainly some of my coworkers here at the college are some of my favorite. I just marvel at the creativity of a Shane Wood. Mm-hmm. I marvel at the speed of mind that a Michael DeFazio has, that the solid evangelistic thrust of a Mike Ackerman. So some of my own guys here, you know, and really guys that I had in the classroom like you and Matt Proctor and Jim Johnson and Jeff Snell and Doug Aldridge, people that I had the chance to share a classroom. It's neat to see those guys that have gone way beyond their teacher in their abilities to communicate the gospel. And so those would be some. Now, to answer your question more directly, though, there are a few favorites I have. I think this, you're going to think this is very self-serving and very biased, and it is. I enjoy listening to my oldest son. Mm. You've had him on your podcast, mm-hmm. and you wind him up, and he's like a toy that doesn't go down. But really, he's very, very creative. His introductions and conclusions are just classic. His dominant thoughts, his main proposition or thesis, the big idea of the sermon, he just nails it. I really enjoy listening to Casey an awful lot. And what's nice about the hour difference from Joplin to Indianapolis is I can do it before going to church.
That's right.
So I get to hear him before I get off to his early service gives us that time. I would also have to say, of course, you know this to be true of me. I'm a real Fred Craddock fan. I think that he learned how to spin a story in a way that he doesn't have to make much application at all. Mm. We often distinguish illustration from application. That's not necessary with Fred Craddock. He'll tell the illustration and it carries the application. He didn't have to say anything when he's done. Mm. You know what that sermon's calling you to do. Mm-hmm. And that ability to combine those two elements of story and if the illustrative side of the sermon with the application, he is probably keenest. One of my favorite preachers is David Erickson, now the associate teaching pastor on staff at Academy Christian Church, Colorado Springs. David is more inductive than deductive. I can lecture on inductive. I'm too impatient to pull it off. Although yesterday, my DT, my big idea, came at the very end of the sermon. Uh-huh. That's not typical for me. I think I understand it. I don't do it very well. But David does it very well, tends to be more inductive than deductive. But his wordsmithing, I guess you could say it would be a throwback to a more oratorical era. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sometimes in older African-American preachers, we still have that oratory, but even the younger African-American preachers are not moving in that same level of oratory mm-hmm. from days gone by. But David does it still by using a vocabulary that's stunning, but not stuffy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem so just academic.
Yeah.
It's very authentic.
Quick note on David Erickson. I asked him one time how many words he produces per sermon. See, I know typically where I land for, I land right around 2,000 words.
Yeah.
But he speaks so fast.
Yeah.
He's manuscript too. And so yeah. He's an excellent reader. And so it doesn't sound like manuscript. It sounds like it's just, it's just this beautiful, just fabric that he's just, you know, weaving together. And he was somewhere in, if I remember right, it was like 5,000 or 6,000 words.
It's over 4, I think.
Yes. I mean, it's incredible how many more words he was saying versus, and I'm like, I preach 40 minutes. Am I saying anything? Like, this is, like, this guy goes 25 and he's doubling. I'm like, this is it. Yeah, but he's incredible. He's incredible. Yeah,
he is a wordsmith of gargantuan proportion for sure. Yeah. But I'm always stimulated. He's also not just an exposition guy. He's probably a little bit closer to more of a theological type of preacher, big picture idea. But he pulls some things together that just always move me. Mm-hmm. So those would be a few. I enjoy listening to Casey. I enjoy listening to my students. Yeah. We've got students here that in the last few years are outstanding communicators and preachers. And your own era that you guys, when you came through, I always enjoy that.
Well, Ackerman, DeFazio, Shane Wood, there were several all right there in a row.
You know, that's right.
That I had class with as well.
I'm blessed by the young guys. They help me. They're much more creative than I am. And so I try to steal well. I do quote them. I do tell where I got it. But anyway.
Yeah. I was having a conversation with a guy the other day. And he'd reminded me of this probably a year ago. And then it wasn't long ago. He called and he said, "Hey, are you getting Mark Scott on the podcast or what?" And this was my roommate when I was in school, Colt Mullings, if you remember Colt Mullings.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And Colt said, "Did I ever tell you the story about when I took the Gospel of Mark with Dr. Scott?" I said, "No." Excuse me. I said, "No, you didn't." And he said, "We were on the section of the crucifixion." He said, and Mark Scott is always, he's always buttoned down. He always looks nice. His stuff is always tucked in. He's always just buttoned down really good. And I said, yeah. He said he came in this morning that he was doing the crucifixion. He was lecturing on the crucifixion. He said his hair was messed up. He said he looked like he hadn't slept all night. He just looked just disheveled. I mean, his shirt was just, you know, untucked. He looked like he'd been wrestling in these clothes all night long, and he came up in front and he was adjusting his glasses and he started talking and he said, "I gotta be honest." He said the class went quiet. He said class went quiet because this was just not a scene that you saw from Dr. Scott. He said, and then he started and he said, "I've been up all night wrestling with this crucifixion story because I'm gonna stand in front of 50 kids who already believe this. But I still want to get it right." And Colt said, "That's when I understood that the crucifixion is not important. It's the most important." Like, that testimony was so big to me that he wrestled with that all night long about something. And that's something that can kind of haunt a guy once you hear it, you know? And so, well, I appreciate that. I do too.
I'm grateful for that marker in his life in our class. That's one of those days I do kind of put away the notes and I just pull out my Bible and I just try to say, this text is bigger than just words on a page. This is an event that transforms us. I've often called it Catch the Spirit of Calvary when I've preached it. And that's a day when it probably has a little bit more of a hortatory element preaching to it than just teaching lecture in class. But yeah, that's no small thing to me.
Yeah.
It's not just an academic exercise at that point. It matters.
And why is that? I mean, I understand why it's important and I understand, but why personally to you does it weigh so heavy?
Well, I guess just because I feel like it is the real guts of the gospel. It is really what the gospel is. 1 Corinthians 15 comes to mind, you know, the death, the burial, the resurrection. And so to me, when you're dealing with those, let me say it this way, primal realities, you know, they're not just surface issues. They're things that are deep within each of us. I think the gospel narrative gives us kind of the storyline and the epistles help supply what did that mean that day? You know, like 2 Corinthians 5:21, that he who knew no sin became sin so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Mm-hmm. Now that's theologically lofty, but it's the underpinning of what's happening in the narrative. And so the power of the story is in the story. So just tell the story. And I guess it just still moves me. It really does to this very day.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Do you find that when it comes to preachers, oftentimes it's really easy for us to get into a pattern to where something like that does not take on the weight it should in our own life and preaching?
Sure. Sure. I think that happens lots. I think it, on the one hand, it can be just ringing with sameness because we've done it more than once. Mm-hmm. But that's not all bad. I eat three times a day too. And that doesn't get old.
Yeah.
But the other side is, you know, sometimes the enemy can make us go bland. The things of God become common and we forget what we're handling here, that this is the word of God and it's no small thing. So sure. I think that they can, it's like what Richard Allen Farmer called the bland leading the bland.
That's good.
This is not something that we want to be bland about. This is something that really has passion and life and death. And so.
That's good. Are there certain pitfalls? I mean, certain pitfalls that preachers can get into that cause something like that to really lose its life in the pulpit?
Well, I certainly think so. I would say yes to the question. One of the things that happens is, how should I put this? I just mentioned the word sameness. It can ring with sameness, I guess. But making it just, again, things, it becomes common to us. Nothing stirs us. I believe that better preaching comes from better preachers. And what I mean by better preachers is better people. That the better people, the more our own well is being refreshed by God himself, that our walk with Christ. I remember a day in class at Denver Seminary with Calvin Miller when he, in kind of an uncharacteristic moment of seriousness, because he was normally a clown, and it was just a lot of fun in class. But somebody asked him, are you a better preacher now than when you first began? Which I thought was a stupid question because I thought, what do you expect him to say? No, I got worse with practice. Anyway, but in an uncharacteristic moment of seriousness, he said, I don't know if I'm a better preacher. I hope I'm a better human being. And I guess that's part of the key is I keep preaching long enough. Maybe I'll convert me. If I keep preaching at this, maybe it'll change me. So that's why Dr. Stephen Olford says, when you get your sermon done, make sure you get it Wednesday or Thursday done so you can get on your knees and preach it to God, first of all. Preach it to yourself, second of all, you know, so that you got a few days to live this out before you stand in the pulpit, so that you can preach that with integrity because it's affected you. And once it has affected you, you're going to be much more likely to have its own natural passion. You won't have to stir up any passion. It'll be there because it's reaching down into you.
That's really good. That's a really good. What was the quote again? Who was the guy?
Calvin Miller. Yeah, Dr. Miller. So I preached in Omaha for years, helped with Robert Smith Jr. for a while, Samford University, taught homiletics, came here and did a seminar for us at Ozark, actually, Baptist in background, then died untimely, too early, way too early. But he's the guy that wrote the trilogy. He's written quite a few books. One is Disarming the Devil, I think it was. And anyway, the singer wrote The Spirit, the Word, the Story, Calvin Miller. I was fortunate enough to have him in class for Denver Seminary. But anyway, his statement again was, I don't know if I'm a better preacher. I hope I'm a better human being.
Yeah, that's good.
I just hope that we fill the pulpit with more authenticity and integrity when we're being changed by the message.
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably always been there. But I think due to the internet and just how small our worlds are right now, we're seeing a whole lot of preachers kind of coming undone at different places, falling out of the pulpit. And it's always the same thing, isn't it? It's always the same thing.
Like, it's second power, it seems to be.
like it's almost this magnetic pull of, like, if you're going to screw your life up, let me guess, I can name the top three things that have happened here. You know, sure. We're seeing so much more of that. And what do you think some of that comes from? I mean, I understand, like, better preaching comes from better preachers. Mm-hmm. But what do you see this as? You see this as a recipe, like two parts overworked, one part too much freedom, two parts celebrity mindset, one part ego. What do you see here?
Boy, that's tough for me to. I like how you're saying it, Jared, in terms of the parts, but I don't know that I got the math in me to figure that one out. I think the enemy's working overtime. Ken Eidelman used to say he's no longer satisfied with sheep. He's going after shepherds. And I think that he knows his time is short. And so he's really, we're in the Western world, especially, the enemy is really working. He can't be omnipresent. He is spirit. He's not physical, but he can't be omnipresent. So he can't be everywhere at once. So we'll see his work, I think, more in the Western world right now than we've seen in other places. The church is growing in Africa and South America and other places far east, but not so as much in the Western world. I think so some of it would be the enemy's working overtime. Mm-hmm. I think another thing is what you mentioned, the celebrity status of preachers. Boy, they're out there. You can find anything on the internet and anybody. And that just promotes us in a way that I think is not very healthy. When you start believing your own press clippings, you might be in trouble. You're not as great as you think you are. Just talk to your wife. And you probably have more chinks in the armor than you think. And just coming to grips with those helps you, I think, be a more authentic preacher. So you're right. The methods, the devil's not very creative. The methods are the same. His MO of deception, discouragement, that's pretty much where he lives.
Yeah.
So the nature of our falling, our depravity side, are pretty much the same things as you mentioned throughout the generations. But yeah, when we throw in the towel, sometimes it is overwork. I wouldn't deny that. But you know me, Jared. I'm probably err on the other side in that I believe that yes, we need Sabbath, but it also says 6 days thou shalt labor. Yeah. And so I probably err on the other side. Certainly one can become burned out and not practice Sabbath enough. And that becomes a part of it too.
I called David Bycroft one time and I said, Dave, I said, I'm struggling. As soon as he started talking, I mean, as soon as it came out of my mouth, it was like, you're an idiot. Like, you are an idiot. You realize what you do. This guy has been preaching for 40 years. Here I am on year, nine? You know, nine. I'm just really tired. You know, Dave, I'm just really just tug. Like, what do you do? Have you ever hit that wall? You're uninspired. You read it and it's flat on the page and you can't, it doesn't matter what you do, how much you pray for the Spirit to just renew you. Like, there's something. And he says, oh yeah, Jared, I've been there several times before. I said, what'd you do, Dave? You kept plowing through. Well, yeah. Well, he said, here's the thing, Jared. You just got pushed through it.
You're expecting some great profound remark, huh?
I thought, okay. Like, he checked me. Like, this is the equivalent. This is the equivalent of a cup check. You know, yeah, it's just right, like right. You just got to be tougher. Push through it. Like there's mornings you stand up there and you have worked a funeral and a wedding, and somebody close to you is going through a divorce, and you were a part of the marriage counseling, and you've got your own problems at home, and you and your wife are arguing, and your kids are doing bad in certain areas, and you're exhausted, and you stand in the pulpit and you feel empty. You've got this scrawny script you're supposed to deliver and you can't. And what you do in that moment is push through it. Do your job. Faithfulness is the key. And I was like, like I needed to hear that more than I needed to be inspired, you know?
Yeah, that's like, true. That was good. I think there's a way that we can be professional and push through it, do our job without professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
When the ministry just becomes professionalism, then it'll be stale.
Yeah.
But if we can say, the Bible is bigger than my puny little life. And if I don't want to make sure that when I preach the Bible, it doesn't have to go through the sieve of my puny little life every time. It's bigger than I will ever be able to live.
That's really good. That's really good, Mark. And that's kind of a callback to a John Piper thing, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a callback. Can you dive into a little bit difference between professional and professionalism?
Well, I think it's a matter of competence, that our competence shows, gotcha. Our training shows, our rhythms, our disciplines show by being professional. That when we've had a spit spat with our wife, we still stand in the pulpit and it doesn't just cave us in.
Right.
We do our job. We deliver the message that day. Professionalism, I think, is when you put such spit and polish on it that it becomes people that have their radar out, their spiritual antenna out, they realize something's phony here.
Mm.
That's a good message. I'll give you a classic example. Years ago, actually it was a time when Miss Carl and I were struggling a little bit, went to a different church service, and I heard what I thought was a perfect sermon.
Mm.
Every T was crossed, every I was dotted. Theologically, it was straight as an arrow. It was perfect, and it was lifeless. There was absolutely no, and I got in the car and I said, that was the closest thing to a perfect sermon I've ever heard. And yet there was no life in the congregation, no life in the preacher, no life in the sermon. About a week later, found out that the preacher was having an affair. And I think that's the difference is, and you just know it deep down in your knower. Something is off here. It can be perfect. So that's not what I'm talking about when I speak about being professional and pushing through it, to use Dave's phrase. But the professionalism kind of rots your socks. You know, it reeks with lack of authenticity and transparency. And so, but being professional, stepping up and doing your job when you got to do your job, that's a different thing. And that's where the disciplines hold you.
Yeah.
That's where the rhythms of, like Craddock says, you know, discipline is a great liberator.
Yeah.
And I believe he's right about that.
Yeah, I agree.
This morning, Monday morning here at the office before our time together here, I mean, I'm cranking on next Sunday's sermon. It's the last Sunday of the year, and I'm doing my hard chair work this morning. I'm pulling that stuff together. And, so it'll take me all day to do that and then try to put it, just because it's Christmas week and rhythms of the church will be different. So I need to make sure this is in by tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that the secretary can do the PowerPoint stuff and get it all ready for, because she deserves to have a few days off this week. So that's what excellent. I mean. Monday morning, you know where you're going, and it's your disciplines that carry you through.
Yeah. Well, that's a good segue. I mean, when you talk about a spat with your spouse, a spat as, you know, you're trying to get to the pulpit, and what you really want is everything just kind of buttoned down, like we're in good shape and I can step into this with a really clean, but boy, I tell you what, it's just like you said earlier, like the devil is looking to mash you to pieces. Like he's not going to let you walk up, five steps before you get there. And somebody walks up and says, I want to talk to you about the children's material downstairs. Yeah. I don't know if you know this or not, but there's mold growing in the, and there's a lady over there. And I don't know if you heard, but it's like, perfect. Like I feel so awesome right now, you know?
Yeah. And if you have a little bit of people pleasing in you,
oof.
And we all probably do, because we got into ministry in part because we want to help people.
Sure, sure.
And we love God by helping people. So all of us have some of that in us and a little bit of messianic complex, I reckon. Uh-huh. And so you combine those, and yeah, those conversations in the foyer can just derail you uh-huh. as you're walking up to the pulpit. You could we have had this conversation any other time but right now? That's why some guys kind of come from the green room backstage, because they don't want anything to derail them. I want to be out in the, my theology is to be in the congregation and sing with the congregation, because my theology, now the church will speak to the church. Mm. That's kind of when I get up. And so I view myself first and foremost as a church person. Mm. But I know why guys do it. Don't associate. Some guys are in a zone, you know, backstage before they come out, because they don't want anything to derail it. I kind of wonder if we shouldn't build church buildings without foyers. But anyway, so I get you about that.
Let me tell you this. This is kind of interesting. At one point, our church transitioned from one building into another, and we moved into an old theater.
Yeah.
This old theater didn't have a foyer. And you don't think about the functionality of a foyer. It's just like, you know what you do in a movie? You don't stand out in the lobby and talk to me. Get your ticket, get inside, get it, watch your movie, go outside, like in the story. Like it's like, and so like the community aspect of church was completely different. But I appreciate what you said, like that messianic complex. I think it was Bono from U2 who said, there's got to be something wrong with you if you have to hear 70,000 people screaming your name for you to sleep good at night, you know? Sure. It's like, yeah, yeah. I mean, if you finish your sermon and immediately you go to Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or your live stream or your website to see, I wonder how much they're loving me. It's kind of like, that's dangerous, you know? Like you're in a really bad groove and you might be out of bounds, you know? You shouldn't have to go see this stuff. And then I'm going to like it. They liked it. They do. I mean, now you're in a really ugly, you said something nice, like you shouldn't believe your own press clippings. We call it something like you shouldn't eat your own BS is what you shouldn't do. You know, like that's just,
well, nice. And here's the other thing, because our lives are so intertwined with what we do, preacher and profession, it's hard to separate them. And so when somebody attacks our preaching, we feel like they're attacking us because those are so inextricably linked. And that's why Dr. Haddon Robinson in our classes at Denver Seminary, he would tell us, don't even look at your sermon until about Tuesday from last week, because you're not ready to do that. There's an adrenaline rush with regard to cramming 20 some hours of work into 30 minutes that you're not ready to hear it in the foyer or later that day. I don't know what you do. But Sunday morning, I can walk out. If I felt like I taught the text fairly well and communicated and kind of had some reaction, I feel decent about it. As the day wears on when I'm watching the NFL, I'm starting to hate that sermon I preached that morning. And by evening, I hate myself. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really not ready to evaluate this till probably Tuesday. And I think he's probably right about that.
Yeah. I had a great conversation with Aaron Brockett about that same thing. And he said the same thing. He said, preach a sermon. He said, I think to myself, it's a 10. He said, by the time I get done, he said, I'm on my way home. He said, it's a 6. He said, by the time I turn on the football game, it's a 3, you know? And I said, that's funny, Aaron. I said, I was talking to Andy Turner last week. And if you remember Andy Turner, he's at LeClaire Christian Church. And I said to Andy, I said, hey, Andy, I said, how do you feel about, you know, sermons and, you know, like when you get done preaching one and, you know, this kind of, he said, Jared, he said, listen, he said, I'm probably a little bit different than most people. I said, okay, how so? He said, when I'm done preaching the sermon, he said, I close my Bible and I put my notes inside. He said, and I am done with that sermon. Every single thing that I did was the very best that I could possibly do. This now belongs to God, and whatever he wants to do with it, he can do with it. He said, I do not think about it again. And I just go on. And I was like, you should teach a master class on how to disconnect that thing when you're done. Like pull your Ethernet cord out. That way there's no looping feedback into like, you're terrible. You're terrible. You're terrible. You know, like that's,
I envy him.
That's incredible, isn't it? I envy him.
And I think there's something to be said for it as a discipline to just cut it off. Yeah. I don't do that very well. Now I will tell you on Sunday night, I'm already thinking of next Sunday.
Wow.
Wayne Shaw used to tell us about two British preachers, and one that was walking home from preaching that Sunday, and a little kid heard him say as he was going by, give me two more. He was praying to God, like already thinking of the next one. So you do have to think of the next one even before you put this one to bed. And if you put it to bed sooner, that's probably a healthy thing, but we're just not ready. I don't think most of us to hear criticism or commendation too much. The other can go to your head in the wrong way, but we probably just need to be a little bit more, you know, rational about it all.
Hey, this is a little more of a touchy-feely question. I'm just curious about it. In the moments that you that somebody comes up and they compliment you on something that you've done or said, like you hear the really plastic answer, right? Yeah. For instance, let me give you this. There's this guy I know, and I love him. He's a super good guy, and he's constantly wearing sweater vests. Okay, and he's really buttoned down, just really always looks good. And one day I'm talking to him, and I said, wow, this is a good looking sweater vest. You know, I noticed it and it looked good on him. I wouldn't wear one. I love it. It looks good on you. Like, that's really good. And he just looks down and he goes, praise the Lord. And he turned. And it makes me think about oftentimes when a sermon, hey, you did a great job. Well, praise the Lord. And it's kind of like, it's almost like getting scolded, you know, you need to praise the Lord. Okay. You need to get your, I'm not God. Okay. It's like, no, I wasn't saying that, you know?
Well, there's something to be said for deflecting the praise to God. And there are certain people that I knew, like Don DeWelt and others, that when they did that, it was genuine. Mm. I mean, it was the real deal. He meant it sincerely. But most of us probably are better to just take the compliment in the belly and just say, oh, gee, thanks.
There Appreciate you go. That. I love it.
Go on with it. Don't, you know, you're not as good as they might have thought. Yeah. But just take it as a genuine compliment. Say thank you and move on.
You know, a little antidote to some of that Sunday afternoon depression that I've kind of figured out is that, I really do appreciate somebody coming and saying that's really good. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the thing is though, like that's not the problem though. Part of the problem is the scale in your own head. Like, how did you do? Like, oh, I bombed that. Somebody else says, oh, well, I think you did great. Your wife says, oh, I think you did great. It's like, well, that's because you don't know what the heck you're talking about. That's the only reason.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's right. The messed up scale instead of just going, you know what? I appreciate that. I really do. That's a good thing for me to hear. I appreciate you saying that.
Sometimes the ones you appreciate most probably have greater specificity.
Yeah.
The people that come out. And like Wayne Shaw said, sometimes when they said, oh, Pastor, that was the best message you've ever done. What they're really saying is, we love you.
Yeah.
We're glad you're a preacher. That's what they probably really mean. But when you have somebody come out and say, you know, I have never understood that passage. And today I feel like for the first time in my life, I know what it says. That, you know, or something, somebody in the sermon with it, that they got more specific about it. Maybe it's something that hit them, you know, not just new, but hit them in an emotional way. It raised the level. The emotional climax was maybe the same for them as the big idea climax of the passage. But anyway, those are the ones you kind of appreciate because you feel like, okay, we're getting somewhere here.
Yeah. Yeah. What was one of the best compliments you ever got to a sermon? Something you've done? Do you remember one specifically to where there was somebody maybe that you admired was there or they said something about the way you did something and it's like, I worked to do that.
I can remember an awful lot more on the other side of that divide. You know of my great respect for our founding dean, Seth Wilson.
Uh-huh.
And when I was to preach on the subject of worship in chapel, and I decided to go with John 4:16-26, Jesus' conversation with the woman at the well, because she raises the question of worship. Uh-huh. And the Greek word proskuneo appears more per square inch in that passage than anywhere else in the Bible. So I decided to preach on that little part of the dialogue between Jesus. And so I was bouncing some of this off Brother Wilson at the photocopier one day. And I was getting, of course, he was beginning to just go off, you know, on it. And so I was thinking, I'm taking mental notes on what Brother Wilson's teaching me there at the photocopier. So I get done with it in chapel thinking I've incorporated some of what he was thinking and thought this will be good. He came up to me and said, oh, that was different. And he walked away. So I've had an awful lot more of those kinds than I've had other kind. But let me tell you one that stuck with me. And this was not a sermon, Jared. This was a lecture. Mm. I was lecturing on preaching the legal genre of the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments, the law, how to preach on the law in a Christian way. And it's what Daniel Block calls the constitutional literature of the Bible. And I was emphasizing that, you know, when we preach on legal passages, you have to get at the precept, thou shalt not steal.
Right.
And then the principle behind it, well, God wants us to be givers, not takers. And then ultimately to the person, God himself. This law tells me something about God. So I was dealing with precept, principle, and person. And kind of laying out, and Mike Ackerman came up to me after that lecture and said this, probably one of the nicest things I've ever had. He said, I sure could have used that when I was an RA in the dorm. And I thought,
that's good.
What did you just say? Huh. And he said, I could have used that when I had to go into a room of a student and say, hey, turn your stereo down. That was the precept. But I wish I would have known to tell him, look, there's a principle behind this rule in the dorm. And the principle is about loving your neighbor as yourself. And what's behind that is God himself. Mm. And in other words, that was a very specific response to a lecture that had some real feet to it.
Yeah.
And that's the kind, I think, for me, when I have somebody come up and say, you know, I've read that passage a thousand. My dad came up to me a few Sundays back because I'd been preaching at Park Plaza where I am now, kind of spot and miss in the fall. Kenny Bowles and I kind of carried the torch there for a little while to give B.A. Austin a break. And I preached on the passage of the Great Invitation. Come unto me, all you, it was Labor Day. Mm-hmm. All you who labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And I told the people, the word easy doesn't mean easy. In Greek, it's the word well-fitted. It was talking about a yoke that you'd put on an ox to pull a plow, and the yoke fit the ox well so he could pull strong with the shoulders of his torso, you know, to be able to pull the plow. So I said, it doesn't mean easy. I've never found following Jesus easy. Mm-hmm. I've just always found it best. Mm. It's well-fitted. My dad comes out to me. This is a guy that was in ministry for 50 years. Preached his last sermon when he was 90 on the resurrection on Easter. And that was it. He called it good. He called it quits then. So my dad at age 93 comes out of the foyer. And this is the church where he attends. And he's Walker. And he says, you know, son, I've never preached on that passage. I said, you've got to be kidding me. You've never preached on the great good invitation? No. He said, because I never felt like I knew what that meant. My yoke is... Okay, so I'm giving a 93-year-old guy who's preached for 50 years an insight that he never had, and I'm blown away by that comment. So those are the ones, the specificity, those are the ones that stick with me. It's not that you're the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know, or that you just, you know, the kingdom was waiting for you to come down the pike. Mm-hmm. No, that ain't the truth. What's really is once in a while, God gives you one that sticks with somebody that's in a specific. Yeah,
that's really good. That's really good. How wonderful. Hey, this is one of my favorite questions. You were talking earlier about you have an argument with your wife, and it made me think of this, you know, as a preacher, like you really can't use that as an argument for like, well, sorry, my sermon was bad. I mean, because I mean, at least you're not Hosea, right?
Yeah. Not married to Gomer.
Like it's kind of like, me and my wife had a spat. Oh, did you? Was it bad? Was it real bad? You know, did you have to go buy her back? Okay. Then how about this? How about you just worry about you? How about, you know, what's a passage of scripture that makes you laugh?
Well, I think the Bible's actually pretty funny in places. Now the Bible's humor, as Jeff Snell noticed when he did his doctoral dissertation at Southern Baptist in Louisville, is primarily irony, sarcasm, and paronomasia, play on words. I quoted yesterday, not a statement from scripture, but Caesar Augustus said you were better off being Herod's sow than Herod's son, and Herod the Great. And because the sow had a better chance of living than the son, who would probably be killed by his dad. Yeah. And there's just one letter difference from sow and son
that's
in
good.
Greek.
Yeah, that's good.
And so that play on words is good. I think one of my favorites, though, is 1 Samuel 21. Now, this is not a good thing because David is escaping from King Saul. And he asks, have you got any bread? there at the, you know, the priest, and they give him the table of showbread stuff. So, you know, he eats that, takes off. Well, then Saul comes by and kills them all, you know, because they helped his enemy, David. But David goes and claims to be insane with King Achish, you know, kind of doing undercover work against the Philistines at the time. But when he feigns insanity, when David does, and he has spittle running down his beard, King Achish says, "What? Do I not have enough madmen that you bring me another one?" I think that's pretty funny about King David.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, or like my dad, you know, when it says about the boy at the foot of the Mount of Transfiguration, when he says that, "Have mercy on my son, for he's a lunatic." You know, and I thought my dad probably often said that about us five boys. Right. "Have mercy on my son, for they're lunatics."
Yeah.
It means moonstruck, of course. He's epileptic. That's what it means. But I don't know. I just think some of those places are really funny. We've lost the punchlines because we know them.
Yeah.
You know, we know the punchlines in the Bible. So when Jesus said, you know, about the man who has a plank in his eye, mm-hmm. can't see the speck, and, you know, just that's, it's not funny to us now, but it was the first time people heard it.
Right. Right.
Pretty, so yeah. I don't know. I've just always like, what, do you bring me another madman? Like, yeah. I don't, my kingdom doesn't have enough madmen.
I don't remember what version it was, but is there a shortage? Do I have a shortage of
shortage
of madmen here? You know,
I just
covered that one a few weeks ago. I love that line. Was there a shortage of madmen? You know, yeah, that's a good one.
Earlier in the cast today, we talked about Calvin Miller. Mm-hmm. And I just thought I would literally fall out of my chair the day in class at Denver Seminary when he talked about David's bridal price for his wife, Michael, you know, mm-hmm. was Saul had put 100 foreskins of the Philistines as the bridal price. He brought back 200, you know, and so Calvin Miller's covering this text and he says, but there's a footnote in the Living Bible, he said, that says the Philistines gave them very reluctantly. Anyway, I just thought I was going to fall out of the chair. Some of those things that are so kind of sexual and connotation in the Old Testament are pretty graphic.
Yes.
And it's go, wow, okay then.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's real good. I've said this one before. One of my favorites is Jonah. Mm. You know, the midst of the storm.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, who did it? Like who did this here? You know, he's like, it was me. Like it was me. Like you want the storm to stop, throw me overboard. And what I love is they throw him overboard and then the storm stops, you know, which in my mind, if it happens instantaneously, now it's really awkward as they kind of look at him and they're like,
yeah, right.
I don't know. Like, it's good.
Yeah. I love how it ends. I think it ends humorously in chapter 4 that God says, should I not have compassion on Nineveh, this great city that has 100,000 people in it and much cattle? Well, if you can preach to get the cattle to repent, you're doing the job.
You're knocking it out. Yeah, you're knocking it out.
That's right.
I also like God's conversation with him when he says, and you didn't even plant that. You didn't even plant that vine. What are you? What are you mad about? You don't care about the evil. You're mad I killed a vine. Like, isn't that just exactly the picture of everything that's wrong with me? Like, I will get so worked up about something. I cannot believe I got treated like that. Like, that's the biggest thing. Like, you're lucky that you were in a position where you could get treated like that. Like, that's a place. That's a good place to start, you know?
Yeah, that's good. Craddock has a great one. I think the King James Bible says in Jonah 1 that God ordained a worm. You know, eat the plant. And I think he says, so if God can ordain a worm, I suppose he can ordain you. You know,
that's good. Yeah, that's so real good.
Once again, it's not believing your own press clippings kind of thing.
Yeah, that's real good. Can you share about a time in ministry? Now, your ministry has been a little bit different. You've spent some time in the church, but most of yours has been in the college, right? In the college setting.
Yeah, the academy.
Yeah. So can you tell of a time that you've experienced something in there where the ministry was stretching you, or you had something else going on and it was almost burdensome, a season of ministry that just became very burdensome for you?
Well,
what really stretched you, or ministry really
when
stretched
you? I got back from our time in Denver, Mm-hmm. When I, you know, I was here for 28 years and then left as part of a succession plan administratively, and then came back. So in concluding this ministry, that's 35 years total. But in coming back, we kept wondering why God brought us back, because it was pretty obvious that he did to us. But when we were here about 3 or 4 months, and Randy Garris transitioned to the Bible College from College Heights Church, and Chris DeWelt, one of the elders, asked if I'd do the interim. We prayed about that for a week and then agreed to sign on. So doing the interim at the College Heights Church here in Joplin, to be honest with you, really stretched me. We were emotionally spent from our time in Denver. That was a difficult ministry. Felt like we'd been in ministry for 41 years, and yet we were rookies at some of the things we faced. But I was getting up at 3 o'clock instead of 4 o'clock in the morning, just trying to stay level with the work of preaching at the church, as well as doing my studies here at Ozark and lecturing and stuff. So it was a very intense time. And yet I'd have to tell you, a very spiritually gratifying time, because I knew that I had more to do than I had the capacity to produce. And it had to be God, or it was going to be a failure.
Wow.
Because so I was running on, you know, probably 3 hours of sleep, 4 hours of sleep a night, and yet producing, and felt decent about it. Felt like I was doing what God wanted me to do. And so even though it was a very tense time for those about 13 months, they were wonderful moments. And sometimes that's how it is. You know, I think Jesus, when he was really wanted to get away after hearing about the death of John the Baptist. Yeah. And so he goes to the other side of the lake, and all these people forded the waters of Merom that feed the Sea of Galilee and met him. And that's when he feeds the 5,000. It's recorded in every gospel. So one of his greatest miracles came when he was just most spent. And I think that for me, that's when I know it's the Lord providing the energy and the passion, because I don't have it. I didn't have it. So I would say that that would be, and really it's the local church that makes us do what we do here. I think the professors that have probably made the biggest impact have been those that were just always just almost a breath away from going back to the located ministry, because those were the ones that really, they cared about the church, and that's why they were here in the college setting.
Yeah.
And so you know, I mean, I want to be respectful of everybody's giftedness. Not everybody's wired the same way or gifted the same way. So I don't expect everybody that teaches here to have that same kind of thing. But I think that, especially if you teach in the preaching department or Bible department, that boy, you know, you're always just about a half a step away from going back.
That's good. Car guys, they notice cars, right? Singers, vocalists,
I love those guys.
You know, like they just know things, like, you know, just like you notice this voice. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? Like they went from head voice to chest voice. You know, they went from whatever it was, however it worked, you know, like we notice these different things. What are the things that you notice when it comes to preachers? Like you hear a certain thing. What do you notice with preachers?
Yeah. I can't tell you why I notice some of these things, but I just do. We were talking earlier about Dave Erickson. I noticed somebody who really is a wordsmith. Mm-hmm. And I have respect for that without it being flowery. I'm not talking about just being kind of an orgy on metaphor. I'm not talking about that. But there's really solid wordsmithing that advances the sermon. Mm-hmm. I noticed that. I don't know why, because I was a math and science guy in high school. I wasn't a wordsmith. I didn't like English. I didn't like my English teacher. So that's what's bad.
Yeah.
So, but I noticed that today. So everything is switched. I think another thing is the power of story and what story can do. I came to that later in life, but I noticed that. But I'd have to tell you the thing that I noticed the most, Jared, is the area of my own study, and that's self-disclosure. Mm-hmm. When the preacher unzips his heart, when the preacher cracks the door on his own life and does so in an appropriate, powerful way. He's not doing this for self-therapy. He's not doing this to say, boy, if I tell them how bad I am, maybe they'll like me better. It's none of that stuff. But he's just cracking the door. I'll give you a classic example. We were doing, I forget now even the message at College Heights during the interim, but I just mentioned that sometimes our spiritual highs come, you know, and then followed immediately by a real spiritual low. And I hesitated to do it even, but I said something about being in conventions or conferences and you just felt like the Lord helps you really deliver a good one. And you felt good about it. You go back to the hotel room and you flip on the TV and you go, whoa, it's a hot TV, as Dave Erickson calls them. Mm-hmm. And you realize, okay. And I said this in a sermon. I said, I better find a ball game or a news broadcast or those people from Alaska, or I'm going to be in real trouble here in just a minute.
Right.
And I said that just like that in a sermon. And I don't guess people had heard me talk that way about Mark Scott at College Heights, that I was a man with feet of clay and had sexual temptation like anybody else. Yeah. And I had guys lined up after that service was over, said, you got time to talk this week. And I did. I was kind of embarrassed about sharing something so vulnerable like that in my life. But the power that came from that, I just noticed years ago that when the preacher said something about himself, people had to lean in and they went to the edge of their seat. So I still notice that. I notice self-disclosure when it's kind of wrongheaded and when it's overly done. When it's and you can disclose, a preacher can disclose. I get on the kids here at school. I don't mind one or two personal stories, but some of them, everything is illustrated from their personal life. And even if they say it in self-deprecating ways, it's still about them. Mm-hmm. And the sermon can become anthropocentric. And that's not good. The accent, the spotlight's on God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit. So I notice when it's done well. I notice when it's done poorly. I guess self-disclosure is the biggest thing that I notice, I guess, because of my own interest in it. And that's what I wrote about. And so that's where I am.
I remember that lecture from school and the wrestling with that section of the class, you know, and talking about like how much is too much. And they're, and you know, it's probably pretty, you know, different coming into the classrooms. I mean, are you seeing a shift year by year? You know, sure. I mean, coming from your generation where there's so many people who are just like, you don't unlock one single bit of that. Yeah. You know, yeah. I bet you your dad, Dave Bycroft. I mean, those are guys who like you put that back in the box where you found it and leave it there. You know?
That's exactly right. I can tell you this, when we were in the research and methods class for my doctoral program, and we had to go around the room and announce what our topic was that we were going to write on, and I said the self-disclosure of the preacher in the sermon, I got laughed out of class.
Wow.
I really did. There were people in that class, guys that I respected greatly, my peers and coworkers, that just thought, you just don't do that. Hmm. You will lose, your people will lose respect for you. Yeah. If you talk that way about yourself, that is not good. But the professor said, I beg to disagree. Mm-hmm. I think Mark has a good topic. And knowing what's appropriate self-disclosure and what's not. And so what we developed out of that class was this critique form of how to know when you've maybe crossed a line and what is appropriate, what's not appropriate. But that will vary from generation to generation. Kyle Eidelman has said, you know, 2/3 self-disclosure, 1/3 authenticity, transparency. That's his view. And I thought, well, what third does the Bible get? You know, but I was kidding Kyle about that. Sure, sure. But really, he wasn't trying to say that we're not going to preach the Bible, but just the younger generation is craving for authenticity, transparency, vulnerability. Mm-hmm. That's huge to them. Mm-hmm. So you score some points when you speak out of that part of the hymnal for them.
Yeah.
But I still think it can be overdone. I still think there's times when it's inappropriate. I don't think I'm saying that just from a, I'm saying that more as a scientist than I am from a being a boomer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There would be boomers that would be, and there'd be builders, my father's generation, that would really say, okay, like you said, Jared, put it back in the box. Dave Fish's mom, she just thinks that's never good. Mm. She doesn't like it when the preacher cracks the door of his life. That just has no place. And you got people like Richard Lisher and Will Willimon and others that would say be hesitant about it, mm-hmm. because they think, no, we're here to preach the gospel. This isn't about self-therapy for us and things. And I guess I feel like, well, there's a balance.
Yeah.
There's
well, how much of the, I mean, there's so much of the gospel that, I mean, part of the power. And again, I'm not trying to take anything away from the gospel message standing on its own, not one single bit, but part of the thing that part of the thing that relates is incarnation. It's that that part of, and again, I'm not trying to lump me and my experience and my understanding of the gospel into incarnation, you know, tabernacled with you. I don't mean that. I mean, from the standpoint of being able to take this thing and say, do you want to know? It's like what you said a second ago. Is it God working through? Yeah, let me, this is a part of God working through me. Different.
Yeah, it is different. And that's, again, that's why I got interested in it, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example from yesterday's sermon for me. I was covering Matthew 2, 13 to 23. So you got, out of Egypt have I called my son. Seems like Matthew clusters the story of Jesus around these three quotes. Hosea 11, 1, Jeremiah 31, 15, and then, best we know, Isaiah 11, 1, out of, you know, Nazarene. He'll be called a Nazarene. And the word Netzer in Hebrew is probably a slang for that. But anyway, Jeremiah 31, 15, a voice was heard in Ramah, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they were not. Here you got a layered prophecy. You got a reference to Rachel. That's Genesis 35. That's not Jeremiah. But when Jeremiah sees these people, these sons of Israel, hauled off to Babylonian captivity with Nebuchadnezzar, it's as if the mothers of Israel are coming forth from their graves once again and crying once again.
Right.
You got a cloud of death. The theme was silver linings in the clouds at Christmas. So are there any silver linings in the clouds that we see? Fear of the cloud of fear, the cloud of death, the cloud of obscurity. Those were kind of the headings where I came back through them. But I said, if we look at these Old Testament quotes, that's what makes sense. Okay. So how can you bring that home more?
Right.
And to me, I showed a picture of the graves in Burwell, Nebraska, where my wife's sisters are buried. My wife is an only surviving child of seven pregnancies. There was a set of twins, so my mother-in-law lost seven babies. Well, that raises the stakes of that passage. All of a sudden, you realize this isn't just an academic exercise. Oh, yeah, Herod killed some babies in Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Ramah, but probably 12 to 20, given the population at the time, not thousands like we sometimes think, but 12 to 20 babies lost their lives because Jesus escaped to Egypt. Okay, so we're dealing with a real life and death type of text issue. But what brought it home was the first time I stood in that cemetery in the Sand Hills in Nebraska and saw those three little graves, Parker baby, Parker baby, Parker baby. It wiped me out.
Yeah.
And I thought, how did my mother-in-law get through the Great Depression, World War II, and losing seven babies? Well, the way you do it is you get through it by the help of the Holy Spirit and you grit your teeth. And that's why Tom Brokaw called those people the greatest generation, because they got through an awful lot of stuff in life. Now, the point is that that personal self-disclosing illustration about standing in that cemetery for the first time in my life, way after we had married, many years later, when I went there for the first time. But wow, that cemetery meant something to me. And all of a sudden, you can identify with these mothers of Israel who are seeing their babies slain, all because one little baby got to get out of town, got to get out of Dodge. Right. Okay. But the power of it is Jeremiah 31. That's the chapter of the new covenant. A new covenant I will establish with the house of Israel, not like the old. It won't be written on stone. It'll be written on the heart. You won't have to say, know the Lord, for everyone shall know me. That's quoted extensively in Hebrews 8. The point is, yes, the babies were slain. That's awful. That's terrible. You might as well cry about it. But one baby was spared. And one day he would die on a cross and make a new way to be right with God. See, so there's life coming out of death. And when you relate that to your personal experience in a little family plot cemetery in Burwell, Nebraska, then all of a sudden you got something, I think. So that's where self-disclosure makes a difference.
That's really good. That's really good. I preached Christmas story yesterday, and my approach was the it's a Jewish commentary. I don't have it here. I'll send you a picture of it. It's a fantastic commentary series. I was going through it and it was talking about rabbis would rarely teach the creation story to their disciples. And when they would, it would be to one disciple at a time. And then when they would whisper it. And then they would begin to talk about, you know, okay, in the beginning. And part of the reason they did that is they said, it's too big. It's too big. You shouldn't study it. You shouldn't try to, you're going to run the risk of being a heretic, you know, and blasphemy. You don't want to do that. But part of the wrestling seemed to be the Shema, you know, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And then when you get into Genesis, all of a sudden, we've got a whole lot of singulars that go to plurals. We got a whole lot of God talking to himself, or at least somebody else who's present, who's equal.
Right.
And so the idea being like this whole, and so I talked about, this is where it began. And I kind of started with the verse from Jesus when he said, what I tell you in secret, you know, go to the rooftops and yell it. What you hear whispered in your ear, you proclaim everywhere, you know. And so why would you have to? So then I go all the way back. So when John writes his Christmas story, what does he begin with? John writes his Christmas story and everybody's in on the joke. Everybody's winking, nudged, and it's like in the beginning. And it's like, it was so much fun. But, you know, inside that sermon, one of the things that I did was I talked a lot about our own secrets inside of our family, our own ways of doing things. And I talked about, there's certain things you can't know. There's certain things you would never expect coming from our home. And it was just kind of pulling back the curtain, the veil on a few things inside of our life. Oh, like all of them were positive things or, you know, indifferent, you know, just pointless sure. things, but just pulling back the curtain on some of these things just to kind of build this. But it was, there was a whole lot of me and my family in this sermon, which I try not to do that too often, you know.
Yeah. And that's another thing why it's probably good to listen to ourselves, maybe take Haddon's advice, don't do it till Tuesday, mm-hmm. but go back through and say, did that one last week have too much of me in it? Mm-hmm. Did it become anthropocentric instead of Christocentric? Yeah. And so those are good kind of questions to ask after the fact, even. Because you can adjust that. Like Wayne Shaw said, don't plan to preach a sermon, plan to preach a lifetime. And you can, you're not just last Sunday, you're preaching next Sunday too, and the Sunday after that, and the Sunday after that. So you can come at it differently.
Yeah. That's one of the greatest things. That's one of the greatest things about any conversation I ever have with you. It's like I get your wisdom and your advice, and then I get 13 other people's wisdom and advice, because you are loaded with quotes from so many people. You're like the Cliff Notes library guy. You're like the Cliff Notes library. And that's one of the best things about visiting with you, is it's like, so what do you think about this, Mark? I think this, and here's what Haddon Robinson thinks, and here's what Craddock thinks, and here's what Williman thinks, and here's what, like, I love it. That's one of the best things. So I appreciate that. Hey, well, one last question, and I won't hold you up. A lot of guys find ministry, they find these seasons in ministry, they find it to be heavy. They find it to be, get beat up, you know, especially this year, there's been a lot going on. You've seen a lot of preachers. It has just been,
it has been tough.
Been so strange, you know, just so strange. What kind of encouragement or advice can you give the guys that are out there that are in the trenches, that are banging away, trying to, you know, watching their congregation just shrink week after week, you know, wondering if they should be wrestling with laws, where are civil liberties infringed upon? I mean, like what kind of encouragement do these guys need? What can you give these guys?
Mm-hmm. Couple things come to mind. One is when you were by in the hallway the other day with Griff, and I mentioned the Mike Tyson quote that mm-hmm. I was going to start the sermon with Sunday, which I did, and you knew it already. Everyone's got a plan, but then you until you get punched in the fat mouth.
Yeah.
And that's what 2020 has seemed like for sure for a lot of people. I think one thing, and I remember Wayne Shaw saying something very close to this, when you are in a year like we've been in, you hang on to Isaiah 55 with everything you've got, tooth and nail. My thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. But my word, when it goes forth, will accomplish what I've set it to do. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven, so it is with my word. There have been many times I've walked out of the pulpit and thought, oh, dear God, forgive that. I'm so sorry. That was such a poor job. And sometimes I did that after great study. I just didn't feel like it went very well, like a cement cloud that hung over the congregation's heads. But I know that his word's going to do. It won't return to him void. It won't return to him in vain. That it will do what he needs it to do. And you know as well as I do, sometimes that's when the people come out when you think you couldn't even get a bunt down the first base line. They come out and said, that was the best. You have no idea what I, and I'm thinking, I have no idea what you got out of that. That's for sure. But God will use it. And so that's one encouragement, is he will use it. The other is that book by Todd Bolsinger on Canoeing the Mountains. that nothing prepared for, I had no class in Bible college or seminary or doctoral study on how to preach and lead a church during a worldwide pandemic. Right. We didn't have that course. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so, yeah, canoeing the mountains. How do you canoe the mountains? When Lewis and Clark, you know, tried to find the headwaters of the Missouri River, they thought they would find the headwaters to the Columbia and sail out to the Pacific Ocean. What they found was Rocky Mountains. Now, oh, we didn't account for this. Nothing prepared them for that.
Yeah.
So what happens? We'd have to pick up the canoe and canoe the mountains, haul your canoe over the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
That's where we were this year. And my encouragement would be, yeah, nothing prepared us for this. But none of it took God by surprise. Mm-hmm. And so we lean back into what we know. And that's the gospel. That is still good news. And we realize that all of these are seasons. And the old statement, this too shall pass. It's always too soon to give up. And so we just say next year probably won't be like this. There'll be some commonalities. Next year probably look a lot like this year in some ways, especially as it starts. But we realize, okay, nothing prepared for us. My son, who's my second son, who's a worship minister in Springfield, Missouri, he had to take a Sunday off because he was emotionally spent. He said, Mom, Dad, he said, I'm really not tired. I'm not physically tired. But worship ministers had to, with COVID, become production managers overnight.
Mm-hmm.
They had to learn how to do production.
Yeah.
Like TV overnight. And it really was stressful for them. Yeah. So worship ministers had it tough. Youth ministers had a pass. They didn't have to go to camp this summer.
Yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah.
But worship guys, they were pulling their hair out. How are we going to do this online? How's this going to work? So I think we go through those seasons. We realize this is rough. We admit realities. We're not trying to say this didn't happen. This happened. But again, leaning into the word, saying it won't return void. We just keep preaching it. The gospel is still the gospel. The world in which we preach the gospel has changed. The gospel has not changed.
Yeah.
And we keep leaning into that and just showing up every day.
Yeah.
We show up on Monday morning. We start preparing next Sunday's sermon.
Yeah.
And that helps. That's so wonderful. I don't know.
That's wonderful. I appreciate that. Dr. Scott, always, always inspiring to talk to you. I appreciate you so much. I know there was a lot of guys that were super excited about you being on here because they really wanted to hear this conversation. And I've heard that request a few times. So thanks for taking the time to do this.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Jared. Thank you for doing this. And thank you for your tremendous creativity and all that you're doing. Yeah. The Lord is using you in so many, many ways. I take great courage and encouragement about that.
Yeah. Well, hey, thank you very much. Okay. And I'll let you get back to your day.
Okay. Okay.
We'll see you later. Thanks.
Happy New Year to you.
You too.
Thanks.